It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah, 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 we're not afraid here and Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, from the BEA beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com here in Phoenix, Arizona. And we're not afraid. We bring up the controversial issues, bring on the controversial people. Let's do it up. You know, what do we have on today? Heidi Byrick, Special Director, Special Projects for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Bring her on, bring her on, bring her on. You know, how come I can't get on your list? So that was a good first hour. We had some fun with that. And now we're talking about the drug war. You know, drug war. So what we're going to do is go ahead and continue with Mark J. Victor. He's a criminal defense attorney here in Valley of the Sun, a good friend of mine, partner on the Freedom Summit we've been doing for 10 years. And the reason we did the Freedom Summit was because we wanted to have a lot of the people that we wanted to hear speak. And to do that, we'd have to go all these conferences and they'd have, you know, one mainliner or maybe two guys, or if we're lucky, three guys out of 10 or something that we wanted to see. And you got to sit through the others, or you just go walking around or whatever. And you might find somebody that's interesting, or ah, this guy's boring, and you leave and you go out and you talk with other people and so on. And we're just like, you know, we could do this better. You know, we could go ahead and it'd be cheaper for us if we paid for these guys to come, charged, you know, a couple $100, you know, I mean, it's not free, you know, because we got all mainliners. Every single one of our speakers could be a mainliner. Heck, most of our audience could be main speakers. So we go, you know, we'll go ahead and do this and get the good guys. We'll see how it works out. Well, the first couple of years, you know, first year we lost money. Second year we about broke even. Third year we actually made some money. We're like, woohoo! So then what do? We just took the money, put it back into it, because it wasn't really a money-making thing as much as it was. A lot of these guys, they do this as a career. They go around the country. Just that's all they do is these different seminars and so on. And we did the Freedom Summit because we wanted to have top-notch people. We wanted to really, truly understand what was coming from people that knew. Now, in economics and technology and cybersecurity and immigration and, I mean, going to other countries. You know, guys from New Zealand come on down here to the Kiwis. You know, it's all good. And we almost did until they started going communist again, and never mind. But the so what we did is we decided that we would have these great speakers come. And it was all us going around and getting the best speakers of all these different organizations and people that we knew. And we had no slackers in the bunch. I mean, you know, it's amazing. Most presentations you'll go to, they'll have like, yeah, 2/3 of the people will be in there, maybe 3/4. And if you do breakouts, even less and such like that. It's like ours. Everybody's there all the time. And we keep it kind of intimate. Usually we try not to go over 200 people, just enough to break even, pay for everybody's transportation and hotel. A lot of these guys, they'll charge, you know, $5,000, $10,000 to come speak. But for us, you know, because we know them and they know we're not really in it to make a bunch of money, you know, they'll come, hey, cool, it's a weekend vacation. All I got to do is speak for an hour. Cool, we're going partay. And Arizona in the first week in December doesn't suck. So you just type in freedomsummit.com. And you'll start to get a little bit of the information. We're working on the new site now, but you'll kind of get the idea. It's the first weekend in December, and we already have great speakers. Now, maybe I'll read some of them to you here next week. We'll start promoting it next week. Well, my partner in the Freedom Summit is Mark J. Victor. He is a criminal defense attorney, and he and I, back in the, this is before 9/11. You know, this was before the, you know, right when the dot-com thing was going on. It was right when we knew, yeah, it was getting worse. You know, Baby Bush gets in there, and it's no more. Here it comes. And we just said, you know, we got to do this. You know, we need to have, we got to get our current status of freedom. You know, we're not advocating for a central plan for freedom. It's not a seminar where we're saying, hey, everybody do this one thing. That wasn't it. It was just need to get informed on a lot of various different things. You look at our speaker list and you'll go, wow. You know, like Dr. Ron Paul spoken at three of our summits. You know, we have great speakers like that. I mean, before they were famous. You know, now they're freaking all over the news. You know, but we knew, you know, Peter Schiff. You know, we had him back in the day. You know, Lou Rockwell. You know, these guys, you know, we've known them for a long time. Why? Because we sought them out. People that thought the way we did, that knew what was coming. Well, it's here. Well, this drug war thing, you know, Mark Victor, that's what he does. He sees people that are nonviolent, that are productive members of society, that do years in prison for stupid stuff. And it's not stupid on their part. They actually thought they owned themselves. But the government said, no, you don't. Let me tell you what to do. Some people posit that legalizing meth would send the wrong message to people about using meth. However, the government's role is not to send messages to us about what is right or wrong or good or bad. We don't need messages from government. Free people determine for themselves how to run their lives. I have a right to be a self-destructive idiot if I choose. I own me. Additionally, the messages from government objection overlooks an important point. The concepts of legal and illegal are far different from the concepts of right and wrong or good and bad. Because an activity is legally permissible does not obligate people to conclude that such an activity is right or good. Merely because the law allows my kids to insult other kids doesn't prevent my wife and me from successfully teaching them not to do it. The unwillingness or inability of many people to invest mental acuity to distinguish between these concepts has contributed to an intellectual feeble-mindedness, which is akin to a malignant tumor killing our society. The messages from government objection nourishes that tumor. We should embrace the concept that we are free to adopt personal standards of conduct which exceed the minimal threshold defined by law. I regret devoting so few words to the freedom argument. It deserves much more. Many others have far more eloquently detailed the case for freedom. I hope to live to witness the day when the freedom argument is accorded the respect it deserves. I hope the skeletal argument stirs the interest of those who read it and encourages them to explore it more fully. The reason our society has been deteriorating in so many ways is because it has come to accord less and less respect to the freedoms of others. Winning the freedom argument is the only way to destroy the cancer that infects our world. And I'll pause there because, you know, this is the point that he's making, is that we look to government to tell us what's right and wrong. And if we think that they're not doing a good job, we want to tell them how to do it so that we can use the force of government to tell people how to live. I advocate that I not be socially and economically engineered to whatever standard somebody has. The only standard that government has, the only dictate, the only mandate that was given Declaration of Independence was, you know, to protect the right of me to be stupid. If I'm not bothering you, I'm not, you know, interfering with your right to be stupid, then I'll be stupid and try and run my life. Oh, no. We got to have people, they're too stupid to run their own lives. They should do it this way because I know better. Really? Maybe for you. So you're just thinking, you start going down that road, man, you start having a lot of problems. Then he gets into consequentialist argument. And we're only got about a minute here, so I'll go ahead and hold off on that. And it gets a lot more play. It probably gets 2/3 of the paper to the consequentialist argument as opposed to the freedom argument. Even though the freedom argument, you can go on and on and on, but it's still fairly simple. I own me. You know, and if I don't know me, then who does? Society, the collective, the group. I have a duty to what? Now, this is Rahm Emanuel talk. You know, well, every person should, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we're starting to hear the resurrection of this kind of talk from the Obama administration. You don't own you. You have an obligation to the collective, to the state, to your neighbors, to somebody else other than yourself. This was the revelation of Ayn Rand. This is what had such an impact in the days of communism being, you know, all in vogue and so on in Hollywood and such in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And it was, and then you had McCarthyism, everything trying to root it out in the 50s. But her book, Atlas Shrugged, I mean, her whole thing was in The Fountainhead and Anthem and We the Living and a lot of these other books that made her famous or infamous, depending on your point of view. Her whole thing was, you know, it's okay to advocate for yourself. Hey, can I keep my stuff? I don't owe anything to anybody. Oh, heavens and Murgatroyd, that's bad to even say that. Why would they try and brainwash us that way? Because they wanted us to voluntarily give up our stuff.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Chain, chain, chain. Chain, chain, chain. Chain, chain, chain.
Chain of fools. Just a long, long chain of fools. One after another. Fool after fool after fool. One more fool added to another fool, linked to another fool, got a chain of fools. Fool, fool, don't be a fool. And let me tell you, you know, Mark goes on about, you know, the fool. We're reading Mark J. Victor, criminal defense attorney, my partner in the Freedom Summit. About 4 years ago, I think it was 2006, 2007, he wrote this article, Legalized Methamphetamine. And I'll tell you, we distributed this all over. We got lots of copies of this all over Arizona State University. We go to the Pork Fest, we got copies. We got cases of it. And we did this along, he has a bunch of others too, like how to survive a traffic stop and how to carry a firearm legally and, you know, just a lot of stuff. But this one is the one that gets the most impact, and it's the longest one because it really gets down to the basis of the primal question for a libertarian is when I put my hand on your shoulder and go, I just want to ask you a question. Whose life is this? The only acceptable answer is, of course, you know, it's mine, you know, or it may be, you know, God's, you know, it's a gift of life to me. But guess what? You're the ultimate steward of it. You're the one that signs the contract. You're the one that serves the time. You're the one that's held responsible. Or you can say, God made me do it. And you'll see how far that gets you. So I'm just, you know, I it's such a primal question. And it's been asked, you know, throughout humanity's history, I'm sure. Now, here we're going to get into the consequentialist argument. You know, this is, you know, kind of, you know, stats. We're going to talk numbers. Now, a lot of these, keep in mind, are like 4 years old, and it's worse. I can guarantee that. Some people say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over while expecting different results. They are right. The government has been recklessly ramping up the war on drugs for the past 35 years. Every year, we get tougher laws and tougher sentences. Approximately 1.6 million people are needlessly arrested every year for nonviolent drug offenses. 1.6 million. Many more nonviolent drug users are simply charged without arrest. Some of them are students who lose their student loans and can no longer afford college. Others are people who hold professional licenses and can no longer work in their professions. Lives are being needlessly ruined. The growth of the prison industry has mushroomed. We now have private companies in the prison business. This is no surprise when you consider that the United States claims 4.6% of the world's population, but 22.5% of the world's prison population. The DEA has grown from 2,775 employees in 1972 to almost 11,000 employees with 86 foreign offices in 62 countries in 2005. We have well over 2 million people in prison. Since 1980, America's general population has increased 20%, while America's prison population has increased at 20 times that rate, or an astounding 400%. America imprisons more people as a percentage of our population than any other country in the world. This is a sad state of affairs for any country, especially one which refers to itself as the land of the free. Despite the explosive expansion of government to fight the war on drugs, drug use is more prevalent today than it was before the war on drugs started. Additionally, drugs are cheaper, more potent, and easier to get than they were in the early years of the drug war. Throwing more money at the issue has not resulted in fewer people using drugs. Even the federal government admits drug use has increased recently from 6% in 1993 to over 8% in 2003. Despite the frantically increasing efforts to curb the flow of drugs, high school students report drugs are still easy to obtain. Almost 90% of 12th graders report marijuana is very easy or fairly easy to get. Over 47% of 12th graders say cocaine is very easy or fairly easy to get. And more than 32% say heroin is very easy or fairly easy to get. I have had clients tell me they became addicted to drugs when they were in prison. Even in a prison setting, drugs are prevalent. Not only are drugs readily available, some of them have become more dangerous as a result of the drug war. Looking specifically at meth, the drug war has resulted in exacerbating the dangers associated with amphetamine use. While attempting to put the hysteria currently surrounding meth use in perspective, a columnist named Jack Schaefer, who writes for Slate, aptly stated the following. In the mid-1960s, just before the government declared war on amphetamines, the average user swallowed his pills, which were of medicinal purity and potency. Snorting and smoking stimulants was almost unheard of, and very few users injected intravenously. Today, 40 years later, snorting, smoking, and injecting methamphetamines of unpredictable potency and dubious purity has become the norm, with all the dreadful health consequences. If the current scene illustrates how the government is winning the war on drugs, I'd hate to see what losing looks like. Slate, August 3rd, 2005. And then Mark continues. The United States now spends over $50 billion every year to combat the war on drugs. The war on drugs has been a colossal and unparalleled failure. Despite my countless conversations with judges, prosecutors, police officers, DEA agents, and drug dealers, it is extraordinarily rare for me to find anyone who thinks the drug war is working or will ever work under any circumstances. Indeed, despite my countless invitations, I have yet to find anyone willing to debate me publicly on the drug war. Imagine a $50 billion annual program nobody seems willing to defend. I understand why nobody wants to debate me on this issue. I believe the people who work in the justice system and truly understand the problems associated with the drug war know they would be debating the wrong side of the issue. I recently argued the case for meth legalization before a group of judges and prosecutors. I was disappointed during question time when, despite my provoking and challenging them, there was only one half-hearted attempt to engage me on the issues. The case for legalization is overwhelming. I have had occasion to talk privately and confidentially with many drug dealers for well over a decade. I estimate I have represented hundreds of drug dealers. Although some have simply been users who sell to support their habit, others have been major players in big drug organizations. I have found many of them to be bright people who are well aware that an end to the drug war would immediately put an end to their businesses. They realize that they could not compete with large corporations in a legal market. Their ability to make money by manufacturing, distributing, and selling drugs exists solely because of the drug war. They very much want the war on drugs to continue and even expand. Many drug dealers understand that each large drug bust brings increased profits for them. Although a drug seizure is bad news for the particular drug dealer involved, it is wonderful news for all the other drug dealers in the market. When you see government agents celebrating a large drug seizure, imagine all the other drug dealers celebrating along with them. Wow. And we'll continue when we come back. The break's about ready to hit. This is from someone that's on the front lines. This is someone that lives it every day. This is someone that talks to the judges and the prosecutors and the DEA agents and the undercover officers. He deposes them. I mean, I've heard him depose for cases, and we'll be driving somewhere, going to some event or something, and he used to have it on cassette tapes, and he just put it in his car player. You know, years ago, I remember we used to do that a lot. He'd just say, listen to this guy. He'd have them all queued up. He goes, Ernie, you got to listen to this. Listen to this. Listen. I mean, after a while, it just gets old. They just lie. Well, they know better. Well, they're delusional. They're just supporting their job. In fact, a lot of the drug jobs, certainly on a local municipal level, is paid for by federal government. It's that social and economic engineering thing again. You know, nobody goes out and does this unless they're going to make money. It costs them money to be going around busting people for marijuana cigarettes. You know, the thing is that we have, they're number one in car theft in Arizona, and you can't get them to come out, take a report or anything, do it over the phone. Nobody's doing fingerprints or anything. But yeah, no, I think he was smoking marijuana. Here comes the helicopters!
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. Oh, yeah. Yes, my hand.
Yeah, that would be a breakthrough. If I could only reach you, maybe make you smile just a little bit. Just a little bitty bit. You know, but, you know, a lot of this is serious stuff we talk about. I try and make it to where it's not so, I mean, I don't know, so you can sleep. You know, the thing that I'm really trying to make sure that you're made aware. And that's one reason why Mark and I did the Freedom Summit. It was just, you know, we wanted to make sure that our friends knew what was coming. You know, the same thing that we're doing here. It was, you know, we said, look, it's just the Freedom Summit is not advocating one thing over another. There's no central plan for freedom. It's just giving you an annual update of our current status of freedom in this country. That was it. You know, and you look at the About Us, and that's what it's about. That's what it says. So we've done the best that we could, and I think we've had some fantastic. Every one of the summits was just awesome, just amazing. And we get great people, and we're going to have more great people this year. Well, let's go ahead and finish. How much time we got? Yeah, we'll probably finish it before the end of the show. We're on page 6 of 9, so I'm sure we'll be all right. This is Mark Victor giving from a criminal defense attorney perspective on the drug war. And he starts off with the title, Legalized Methamphetamine. And he makes a freedom argument he starts off with, basically, because you own yourself. You know, it's not me, you know, I don't have the right to tell you through any kind of vote or majority or government or delegate authority to somebody to tell you how to socially and economically engineer you. You know, I just, you know, leave you alone, you leave me alone, it's all good. But then he gets into the consequentialist argument. You know, this is what happens when you allow government to take away your freedom. So here we go. And I'll finish off with the last sentence. So when you see government agents celebrating a large drug seizure, imagine all the other drug dealers celebrating along with them because they know their price is going up. They took out another competitor. In fact, a lot of times they turn them in, you know, so they can get rid of competitors. You know, this is, they make deals all the time. And then once they catch you, they get you to turn in other guys. The economics of drug sales are no different than any other product sold in the market. Every big seizure, drug seizure, causes a temporary decrease in the supply of that drug in the relevant market. However, the drug seizure doesn't affect the demand for the drugs. Drug users still want drugs despite some drug dealer being arrested. When the demand remains constant and the supply is decreased, prices go up. Imagine being a drug dealer with a big supply of drugs on hand when prices suddenly go up. It would be accurate to say that the drug dealers gain the most through increased profits when government agents make a seizure. Increased profits also serve to entice people to embark on new careers as drug dealers. Drug dealers love the drug war and do not want it to end. If you support the drug war, you are on the side of and act as an unpaid lobbyist for the plight of the drug dealer. Some of the drug dealers I have met are actually very nice, nonviolent people. I have represented drug dealers who do not use drugs at all. They were simply unable or unwilling to refuse an illegal opportunity to make a lot of money. However, some of the drug dealers I have met are not nice people. They sell drugs with the help of violent street gangs. Some of these gang members intentionally market drugs to kids. Because gang members generally can not utilize the court system to settle disputes over drug sales, nor can they insure their merchandise against losses, violence and guns are necessarily involved. Simply causing meth to be manufactured illegally is by itself a huge problem. As a result of illegal meth labs, toxic chemicals used to produce methamphetamine are often discarded in rivers, fields, and forests. The environmental damage which occurs results in ever-expanding cleanup costs. The massive growth in cost to clean up such environmental messes is also illustrative of the failure of current policy. The DEA's annual cost for cleanup of clandestine meth laboratories in the United States has increased steadily from $2 million in 1995 to $23.8 million a mere 7 years later in 2002. A huge collection of well-documented facts about the failure of the current drug policy can be found at drugwarfacts.org. I have heard the saying that those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it. I suspect some criminal defense lawyer in the 1920s incurred wrath from the establishment for writing an article advocating the legalization of alcohol. I would bet the nice attorney was attacked by small thinkers who repeatedly pointed out the harmful attributes of alcohol. In case you are unaware, the government decided in 1919 to amend the United States Constitution to grant power to Congress to prohibit the manufacture, sale, and distribution of alcohol. Their drug war played out just like ours, a complete and total disaster. However, it was the best thing that ever happened to organized crime. The manufacture, sale, and distribution of alcohol were conducted entirely in illegal and violent markets. Criminals prospered and criminal organizations grew. A major crime wave began in the 1920s and continually increased until the end of Prohibition in 1933, when it immediately started to reverse. Prohibition did nothing to curb the desire of people to use alcohol. Indeed, both the per capita consumption of alcohol as well as the rate of alcoholism increased during Prohibition. Illegal clandestine stills manufactured alcohol of inconsistent and unpredictable quality. Law enforcement was overwhelmed, chasing after people involved in alcohol-related crimes. Does any of this seem familiar to you? In 1933, they figured it out and repealed the 18th Amendment. To be fair, we still have people with substantial alcohol abuse problems. It is a real problem. We have no shortage of alcohol-related crimes. However, violent criminal street gangs do not make money from the sale of alcohol. Although few people homebrew alcoholic beverages, people do not brew alcoholic beverages in clandestine labs. Nobody is offered large cash rewards to transport alcohol. The Budweiser guy doesn't fight the Miller guy if they both happen to arrive at the store at the same time to deliver their drug. Alcohol companies settle disputes peacefully in court. Alcoholics can seek help without the fear of criminal prosecutions. More resources can be devoted to apprehending real thugs because our justice system is not overloaded with cases of people manufacturing, distributing, or selling alcohol. Isn't this obviously a better deal? We know certain things for sure. If meth was no longer illegal, one, all dangerous clandestine meth labs in residential neighborhoods would close. All dangerous street gangs would be out of the meth business. Every dime currently spent on meth prohibition could be spent on real crime. Meth addicts would have no legal disincentive to seek help. The manufacture of meth would be safe and produce a consistent product, and toxic waste from meth production would be safely disposed. If you support maintaining the war on drugs, you must necessarily conclude that either I am wrong about the above six assertions or that the benefits of the drug war outweigh the obvious benefits contained in the six assertions. It is difficult for me to imagine one could rationally and honestly dispute any of these six assertions. They are obviously and virtually guaranteed to flow from legalization. Therefore, a drug war supporter is left with the argument that the drug war's benefits outweigh the benefits contained in the six assertions. His assertions that, you know, the clandestine meth labs would go away, that street gangs would be out of the meth business, that, you know, money spent on meth prohibition could fight real crime, that meth addicts would be able to seek help without, you know, a legal disincentive, the manufacturers of meth would be safe and produce a consistent product, toxic waste from meth production would be safely disposed of. If this is your position, I challenge you to honestly reweigh the costs and benefits of each scenario. Unless you put your finger on the scale because you personally benefit from the drug war, you must conclude legalization wins. I do not intend to claim that the above six assertions are the only benefits of legalization. I list them together because I find them to be indisputable. There are other benefits of legalization. I suspect many people would either not experiment with or stop using meth. Recently, a teenage meth user confirmed for me that she and her friend started using meth, at least in part because it was illegal. I cannot recall any friends of mine who didn't drink alcohol prior to reaching age 21. Indeed, I consume more alcohol prior to reaching age 21 than I do today or since. I've been age 21 and 1 month. In countries where the alcohol drinking age is 16... Yeah, we'll go ahead and stop there. But he's saying here, he's going like, I consumed more alcohol before I was 21 in a month than all the time of alcohol I consumed since then. You know, and I'm trying to think back, you know. And I doubt that's true for me now, but man, it was probably true for me a few years ago. I mean, you know, I drank a little bit. Now, I didn't drink that much when I was younger, but I drank a lot more then than I do now.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
And I pushed a button. There it is. We got legalized methamphetamine is on today's archive. You go to the top of freedomsphoenix.com right now, and you'll see the today's show for this afternoon, and you will have that available. You can download it yourself. I did it. It's all over the internet, but I got it from his law firm site so that you will be able to find it. Now, I'm going to go ahead. I got like almost three pages to read here real quick, so I'm going to try and read it faster to get it in this segment. And here we go. In countries where the alcohol drinking age is 16, rates of alcohol-related problems appear to be lower than in the United States, where the drinking age is 21. The National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse reports that in 2003, 5.55% of Americans were either alcohol-abusing or alcohol-dependent. The Austrian drinking age is 16, and 2.2% are regarded as alcohol-dependent. The German drinking age is 16, and 3.9% of Germans alcohol use is considered harmful. Even during Prohibition, while rates of death from alcoholism and cirrhosis were rising in the United States, they were decreasing during the same time period in Great Britain, Denmark, and Ireland, where alcohol use was legal. I recently traveled to Amsterdam, where marijuana use is legal for those over 18 years of age. Marijuana use among minors in Amsterdam is decreasing. Indeed, the rate of marijuana use by minors is five times less than what it is in the United States. Even among adults, the rate of marijuana use in the United States is twice as high as in the Netherlands, where use of marijuana is legal. Many of the locals informed me that marijuana use is simply not exciting and they virtually don't ever use it unless people from out of town are visiting. As you may expect, I had a lot of questions for proprietors of marijuana coffee shops. I personally witnessed a peaceful and safe marijuana trade in Amsterdam. Although I wouldn't want to live there for unrelated economic reasons, the Netherlands is a good example of why legalization makes sense. Tobacco is a far deadlier drug than is meth. For the year 2000, tobacco is blamed for causing 435,000 deaths. Deaths resulting from the direct or indirect use of all illegal drugs, including meth, cocaine, oxycontin, heroin, ecstasy, for the same year, total 17,000. Despite the fact that tobacco is legal, tobacco use is declining. In 1956, 42% of adults smoked. In 1980, only 33% of Americans smoked. Additionally, in 1977, 29% of high school seniors smoked. 4 years later, the number of high school seniors who smoke had fallen 20% from 29. Education about the dangers of tobacco use can be credited for the decline of tobacco use, which occurred while the drug was legally available and without any of the crime and violence associated with the drug war. The recent rise in popularity of non-alcoholic beer and low-nicotine cigarettes can be attributed to the same phenomenon. The same beneficial effects could be applicable to meth and other illegal drugs. Fortunately, people are slowly waking up to the fact that this war on drugs is the entirely wrong approach. I am encouraged by a courageous group of law enforcement and former law enforcement members who have joined together to form a group entitled Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP. A visit to their website at leap.cc is well worth the time invested. The over 2,000 law enforcement members of LEAP state the following, quote, "The membership of LEAP believe to save lives and lower the rates of disease, crime, and addiction, as well as to conserve tax dollars, we must end drug prohibition. The members of LEAP are willing and eager to debate their views with anyone willing to try to defend the drug war. Also, judges are finally starting to speak out. See judgesagainstthedrugwar.org, which contains judicial opinions critical of the drug war." One of the speakers at the Freedom Summit this year, December, first weekend in December in Phoenix here, is Judge Jim Gray of Southern California. He's one of the most vocal guys coming out against this. And I met him at the Libertarian Party National Convention in St. Louis a month or two ago and invited him to be a speaker. So he'll be coming. And he's just a stand-up, freedom-oriented kind of Judge Napolitano, Judge John Buttrick kind of guy. You know, it's just these guys know. You know, they retire and they say, look, man, this thing sucks. Astute observers of the drug war might point out that the $50 to $69 billion currently being spent on the drug war annually could be used to more effectively address the problems associated with drug abuse. That money could go a long way to facilitate drug abuse education, treatment, and prevention. Additionally, some may argue that legalization of drugs could be administered in much the same way alcohol is currently dealt with. Certainly, people who commit real crimes should be punished whether or not they were using drugs at the time. Legalization of drugs does not mean laws must permit unsafe drug-impaired drivers on the roads. Further, employers and other private citizens would be free to prohibit any and all drug use at their workplaces or on their property, or they can, as they can now with alcohol. Indeed, what would change with a reasonable scheme of legalization would be a deletion of much of the crime and violence only. Everything else would remain much the same or improve. It is a substantially better deal than the ongoing and worsening disaster we currently endure. The drug war is un-American. One cannot simultaneously value freedom and yet support a governmental scheme which denies the individual his or her sovereignty over his or her own body. Indeed, control over one's own body is the most fundamental of all rights. Worse, the drug war has effectively birthed countless violent criminal enterprises. This possibly well-intentioned effort has resulted in effectively creating our 51st state. The state of incarceration. The state's population is growing out of control, and it is choking the life out of the other 50 states. Thousands of peaceful Americans are currently living in cages because of the drug war. The drug war is lunacy, and it must end immediately. As it did for the revolutionaries who founded our country, the time has come for us to be bold and courageous. We must speak out against this horrendous mistake. We have the better case. Mark J. Victor, criminal defense attorney at law here in Arizona. That is a powerful argument, and it's not really, you know, I don't know how you could argue against it. I've seen Mark in debates, at Freedom Summits. I've seen him. I mean, but, you know, one thing, he did get to speak to a group of judges and prosecutors one time at a discussion group. And for them that was there, he was invited to be one of the speakers. And nobody would say anything. They know. What are they going to say? Especially from a criminal defense attorney that's in there that knows, you know, what's going on. And they just keep adding on more things. There was, he had this one case, this one cop had it out for this one kid. And there was a little plastic bag that it came, it was one of those little Ziploc plastic bags you can put drugs in or whatever. but it had something like ear pads for his iPod or something. It was just a little speaker thing, but this kid didn't respect his authority enough. So he arrested him, charged him with drug paraphernalia because of the little plastic bag. That's what they do. And you got to go through all of it, and finally he gets off, and you know, it's kind of, but that's what they do because they can. You know, where that, I always say that, because they can. I'll tell you where that came from. My wife and I, when we had our restaurant, we would often drive home late at night, and we went through a poor part of town where we get to our house, the shortest way to get home. And if you went through there late at night, oh, you're getting pulled over. I mean, it was amazing. It was probably 20% of the time I get pulled over. And after a while, the cops get to know who you are, and you're just going home. A lot of times they leave you alone. A lot of times they wouldn't, just because, And one time we were driving, and my wife, they pulled me over, and she yelled at the cop from the passenger seat, "Why are you always pulling my husband over?" And I'm like, "Well, what are you trying to do? Get me arrested?" And I looked over, and I didn't know what to say. This was like 10 years ago, and she did that. I'm like, whoa. And my wife never, blurts out. I don't know what got into her. This is like, I can count probably three times in my entire, 25 years I've known her that she'd do something like this. And she finally broke. "Why are you always pulling my husband over?" And I think she thought it was some kind of conspiratorial thing and everything, and I knew why. So I just turned to her. I'm like, I just kind of looked at the cop, and I just put my hand up, and I turned to her, and I go, "Honey, because they can." Then I turned to the officer, and he was like, and he felt, that kind of stung him a little bit. And it was that look in his face from me saying that I go, "Oh, that was a good one. Yeah, yeah." So I do that because they can. There's no greater rationale than that. It's because they can. It gives them some kind of positive feedback. Gives them a little adrenaline rush. Gives them a little sense of power. They might even get to write a ticket. They may even fill a quota. It's because they can. This is done for a lot of things. The whole life, I'm with my friends and everything. How come they go, why did they? They all look at me, and everybody just uses allergy because they can. I can't believe this piece of, a friend of mine coming in today, he has to buy this one big sheet of aluminum to put on a bus that he needs to cover a window to do whatever. And he's like, they wanted $400-something for this big, yada, yada. I can't believe. Well, I know why. Everybody's like, because they can. That's right. It's always because they can. And what is it Frederick Douglass says? You find out what people will endure, and you have found exactly the measure to which they will be tyrannized. Tyrannized, whatever. Whatever you will accept is what you're going to get. Stop accepting. Resist. You don't have to be violent. You just go, "I don't approve." Wear a t-shirt. Put a bumper sticker on. Make your opinion known. Because if you don't, they'll think that you're going to allow them to socially and economically engineer you more. Because they can. See? It's not real complicated. Well, we'll tune in tomorrow. We'll have more good guests for you. Who we got tomorrow? Mark Stevens, Adventures in Legal Land. Oh, it's been a long time since he and I talked, so I'm up in Porkfest. Oh, we're going to have a good time. We'll see you tomorrow.